clean up the mess here, I'll just read what's up here instead of what I'm supposed to talk about. Jeez. Okay, that's close enough. My name is Beth Hartley. I'm an alcoholic. And because of the grace of a loving God and the steps and traditions and sponsorship, and I recently heard in Cleveland five brothers who ranged in sobriety from 39 years to 47 years, and every one of them said, I've been sober in AA since June 26, 1988. And I'm very grateful for that. I have to ask now, how many of you, when you came in, ever thought that on a weekend you would come spend a weekend in a room full of women on purpose? Show of hands. If you're new and you're wondering what you're doing here, don't worry about it. We all wondered the same thing. So there's a lot of stuff. If you had told me when I was new, I probably would have turned around and gone the other way. But God, what a great lineup. Some of these are new friends, some are old friends, and Sharon was one of my earliest heroes. I heard her speak at the Kentucky State Convention in 1989. I was about 7 months sober, and I was a biker, you know, when I got here. So, you know, badass biker that I was, if I ever want to remember what pitiful, incomprehensible demoralization looks like, I need to tell you that I arrived at 405 Oak Street in Cincinnati driving a lemon yellow AMC Pacer. That is not in the Harley-Davidson manual anywhere. But then I heard Sharon speak. And at one point, she and her boyfriend lived above a biker bar, and they fought so loud that the biker bar called the police on them. My hero. But it's good to see everybody. I love Girl Stock. I was first here in 2016 and just said put me to work because I'm coming back anyway. I love it here. And for those of you who are big book savvy and are going, hey, that reading isn't step 6 and 7, the steps have a way of winding back around and winding back around, so I will hopefully tie that together before I'm done. A lot of what step 6 and 7 did for me is restore my relationships with my family. Because, you know, even if the character defects are under control out there, because I totally care what the stranger on the bus in the Atlanta airport thinks, right? But then I go home and they're just in full display. You know, I heard once your parents, of course, they can push your buttons, they installed them. So, but I I too was one of the ones that just said, I'm only hurting me, butt out, none of your business. And I got to tell you, well, I talked here in 2016. I think I talked a fair amount about my mom, and I'll probably tell the Jersey Mike story again because it's just illustrative of 6 and 7. But she died almost exactly 7 months after I was here the first time. And for the last 28 years of her life, she didn't have to jump when the phone rang. And she didn't, you know, she didn't even tell me until I was probably 5 or 6 years sober that she used to, you know, she would just want to hide when the phone rang because she didn't know when that call was going to come that either I was dead or I had killed somebody else, you know. But I'm not hurting anybody but me, you know. And it's incredible the scorched earth we can leave around us while we're not hurting anybody but ourselves. Everybody's done a great job so far, and I think Sharon touched on it, but there's promises all the way through the book. And my favorite promises were after the fifth step. There are two that say we can be alone at perfect peace and ease, and we can look the world in the eye. And I couldn't do either one of those. You know, I was never alone at perfect peace and ease. I had an entire committee in my head. They met without me and then would report to me in like board minutes sometimes. Sometimes they would just, you know, you wake up and they're like, thank God you're up, we got to talk. And I still get those every now and then. And, you know, they'll wake you up in the middle of the night and like, oh, sorry, you're sleeping. Never mind, go back to sleep, you know. But I was an only child, and I read a lot. The house could have crumbled around me while I read, and I was always over at the neighbor's house where there were a lot of kids in chaos because I had to have noise louder than my head. Because out of all those voices in my head, none of them liked me. They all said, nobody likes you. I mean, you know, that's pretty clear. And so I... You know, I made a few runs at AA. I never really was in and out of AA. I just kind of did drive-by AA for about 5 years. You know, I would, like, go to treatment to stay out of jail, and then I'd get out of treatment on fire, and I'd give it a good, solid week or two. And then this 6 months to a year would pass, and I'd go to treatment to stay out of jail, and I'd come out on fire, and then, you know, a good 2 weeks would pass, that was kind of, so I never was one of those people that came for several months and drank a six pack and came in on Monday. I was more of an annual visitor. But when your dad's in AA and he gets sober when you're 7 years old, you know that AA has a lot to do with not drinking, and that didn't interest me much once I started drinking, so. Anyway, I have to tell one quick joke. This is for my friend Angie, because we pick on Al-Anon sometimes, you know, in the joking department. So this one's for you. How do you tell an alcoholic from a dog? How? Because when you let the dog in, he quits whining. So, steps 6 and 7, I got it. And if you're in your first, like, not 3 yet, it's like, I really kind of thought the wind had stopped blowing when I quit drinking, you know what I mean? And that there's two little paragraphs in the big book. I was a big book person. And then I turned 3. And in my experience, step 6 comes back around and just slams you in the head with a brick around 3 years sober. And what I realized, a friend of mine was talking, and he said, well, I know I'm lustful, but what if I ask God to take it, and he does? You know, because what if I never get laid again, you know? And he's like, I know I lie, but I lie to get what I want. And if I quit lying, how will I get what I want? And all of a sudden, those who know me know I'm a visual thinker. And just all of a sudden, I had this picture of, you know, like a carpenter belt, you know what I mean? And my character defects were all my tools in my belt that I would whip out to get what I want. Lie, steal, manipulate, you know, gain, you know, shame, guilt, anything. Anything I can use to make you comply. And I realized that Alcoholics Anonymous wasn't saying don't use your tools. They are saying take the tool belt off and lay it on the ground. And if that's not bad enough, then they go, oh, and by the way, hold hands with God and us. So now, I'm with God and us, and my tool belt's down there. And, you know, which one do I let go of to get my tool belt? You know, neither is a real good choice. And so I realized I was going to have to leave it on the ground, you know. And they don't go away forever. Sherry Reynolds used to say that character defects never go away. They just go off stage and change costumes. You know, we stay sober a while, and they start dressing in better clothes, and they get a better vocabulary, and they're a little sneakier about what they're doing. But it still comes down to the same thing, you know. It's just, most of the time now, it just makes me laugh, you know. It's like about the time we start realizing that, you know, maybe we have gained some humility, we think, ooh, I could help somebody with this, and it's gone, you know. So it's a tricky thing, but somebody I sponsor called me one day, and she had gotten a review at work, and her review said that she was unapproachable, and she was not happy, you know, and she was like, you know, what the hell does that mean? And I just kind of offhandedly said, well, I don't know, why don't you look it up? And then I probably, you know, promptly forgot that I said it. And so she called me back an hour later laughing out loud. And she said, oh, my God. So here's unapproachable, because none of us are that, right? Aloof, distant, detached, uncommunicative, guarded, unresponsive, unfriendly, unsympathetic, unsociable, cool. I was like, I could go with cool, but no, cold, icy, chilly, frosty. And it just made me think how much a different word can bring a different thought to mind. And what I realized was, and the 6 and 7 in my mind just kind of came together through a series of events. You know, Gary said that, and I realized my tool belt is now no longer my tool belt. And then, you know, I went to work for my mom when I was new because I was just unemployable, you know. And she was a CPA, and she had a firm out in a nice section of town, just a little, you know, hung out her own shingle. And, you know, they say if you spot it, you got it. You know what I mean? Like if somebody gets on your nerves or doing something you don't like in yourself. And there's this one guy that just, you know, we hung out a little when I was new. And by the way, I dated married men because there was no danger of commitment. So dating's kind of a nice word, though. I was the same way, Amy. I was like, I was so, you know, oh, thank God, you know, at least I didn't turn to prostitution. And then I heard a fist step of somebody who did, and that girl was making money. And I called my sponsor so mad. I'm like, oh, my God, she's pulling down $350 a week for like an hour twice a week, and I was giving it away for a beer. You know, I mean... Lee's not here. I was going to have him take that off. I don't usually say that on tape. But so now I'm working for my mom, and this guy starts just getting on my last nerve, you know. I'm probably 4 months sober, and I'm going like, oh, no, God, this time you're wrong. I don't do anything this guy does. Like, there is nothing I do that he does. And, you know, when you say that, just wait. And so a couple days later, I was volunteering in an intergroup, and he came in, and he'd been out of town for 2 weeks, and nobody got the literature, and if he doesn't do it, nobody does it. And all of a sudden, it was like, oh, my God. Every time I see this guy, he has to tell me how important he is, right? How it doesn't get done if he doesn't do it. And I realized that if you asked me where I worked, I would say that I worked at a CPA firm in Montgomery, which was true. But the whole truth was I work at a CPA firm in Montgomery that's owned by my mommy because I am unemployable. And when I started just telling people I work for my mom because it was that or not work at all, then he quit bothering me, and I don't think he changed, you know. But my mom and I bashed heads a lot. She was not alcoholic. If she hadn't given birth to me, I would have wondered if we were really related. But, you know, she just got the worst of me from the beginning. Every problem I ever had, I laid at her feet. It was all her fault, from, you know, short curly hair when everybody was dressed, looked like Marsha Brady. I mean, when I was in junior high, it was the Marsha Brady deal, long straight hair, part in the middle. No, not my mom. And all these things, all of the wrongs that had ever been done to me were from her. And then I got to work for her, and we did pretty well in a work environment, you know. And as I got more sober, she got better. It's funny how that works. But I, you know, we were in a second floor office, and I must have been 5 or 6 years sober by now, because Chuck and I had met, married, and we had caught, my kids were not in my custody when I was new, and they had been in her custody for 3 years before I got sober. And once I got sober, at a year sober, Mom and I talked and decided it wasn't really to the kids' best interest for them to move back with me, because they had been in a clean, safe neighborhood in a blue ribbon school district for 4 years by the time I had a year. And, you know, I was the disruption. They were all doing what they were supposed to do, and I was in a 10th floor efficiency in a crappy part of town. So we agreed that I would catch up to them. And I started going to school, and Chuck and I got a house in the neighborhood next to theirs. And then in 1993, we bought a house in their neighborhood. And they came home, and Chuck got a job with insurance, and that was the last thing Mom was waiting for. But all of that to say, this happened while I was living there. So somewhere in the 5 to 6 year sober range, you know, I would be maybe going to run home for lunch. And my mom would always say, you know, could you pick me up at Jersey Mike's on your way back? And I would just think, it's not on the way back. I mean, you know, I mean, here's our office and here's where I live. Jersey Mike's is there. You know, it's like... not on the way by any stretch of the imagination, but I would, of course, do it for her, but, you know, with the eye roll and the big sigh and the body language and the, because, I mean, you have to let them know if they're inconveniencing you, you know. We can flounce, and so I would get her sandwich, and I'd bring it back, and I'd give her a sandwich, and a few days later, you know, I'd say, I'm going to lunch, and she'd say, hey, on your way back, you know, and this went on endlessly. And meanwhile, I had started with my mom somewhere Keith Lewis used to talk about with his parents. He just started with one of the Ten Commandments, honor thy father and thy mother, because he just couldn't talk to his dad. And he thought, well, I could honor him. And I thought, well, I could, you know, I wouldn't treat anybody else's mom the way I treat mine. So I will honor her and respect my elder and talk to her like she's somebody else's mom. And then other times, if we were in the heat of the moment, I would think, what would you say if you liked her? You know, which is, it works, you know. And so I started practicing trying to become a kinder, gentler daughter, you know, and days that I was focused on how to be a good daughter, we were great. And days that I was evaluating her parenting skills, we were not great. So that, you know, that staying in your own hula hoop has a lot to be said for it. But anyway, back to Jersey Mike. So one day I'm, you know, put upon again, and the thought crossed my mind, like, I wonder what would happen if you just said I'd be glad to.
Really?
You know. So I kind of laid the trap and said, hey, Mom, I'm going out, you know, to lunch. I'm going home for lunch. And she said, right on cue, could you bring me a Jersey Mike's? And I'm like, I'd be glad to, you know. Your gritted teeth. And I got the sandwich, and when I brought it back, I tried to deliver it without the body language, you know. And so probably a couple times a week for the next 2 or 3 weeks, I'm saying, you know, I'd be glad to. And it got easier to say. And then one day I realized I really was glad to. And then one day I heard myself say, hey, Mom, I'm going out. Can I pick you up a sandwich on my way back? Okay. Now, what changed in there? We get all hung up on step 6 and say, I hear a lot in meetings that, well, I've been asking God to take it, and I guess he just hasn't yet. So while God's doing it wrong, I can still be a jerk. And and I realized, because I'd watched this happen, this was kind of hindsight, that what had happened with my mom was I started to take a different action. And while I was taking it, God changed my heart. Because otherwise, it would have sucked just as bad 2 months later to say I'd be delighted as it had the first time. And I realized that when we first got sober, we didn't just sit home and wait for God to remove the obsession to drink. We began to substitute a whole new set of behaviors. Going to meetings, reading the book, praying, getting a sponsor, calling the sponsor, doing what the sponsor suggests. You know, all of this stuff, we didn't just say, God, please remove the obsession to drink. We substituted a whole new set of behaviors for the old ones. And that's what I realized had happened with my mom and this whole Jersey. And I have to tell, too, full disclosure, office to my house to Jersey Mike's to office was about 8 miles. So it's not like she was sending me across town, but that's not the point, you know. But what I realized was that, and this is why the 12 and 12 says this separates the men from the boys. This is, step 6 and 7 is the next big surrender. You know, it is the next one. And they even kind of bring it up, because I found myself thinking, well, if God took the drink, why can't he take this? And somebody thought it before me, because it says, having been granted perfect release from alcoholism, why then shouldn't we be able to achieve by the same means perfect release from every other difficulty or defect? This is a riddle of our existence, the full answer to which may be only in the mind of God. Nevertheless, at least part of the answer to it is apparent to us. And then over on the other page, it says, you know, if we ask God, he'll certainly forgive our derelictions, but in no case does he render us white as snow and keep us that way without our cooperation. And that's, you know, that's the money line there. You know, this is something we are supposed to be willing to work toward ourselves. He asks only that we try as best we know how to make progress in the building of character. So, you know, for me, step 6 and 7 is the same thing as step 1. It's just a different set of actions. And And so as I go through step 6 and 7 now with people I sponsor, what I will ask them to do is, because, you know, there's lots of handy-dandy worksheets out there on the web and everything. There'll be a whole list of defects and a list of their opposites, right? And, you know, that's helpful to a point, but I'm not a noun person. You know, I'm a verb person. I need an action to take. And so if I see, okay, I'm selfish, surprise, you know, and so unselfish is the opposite. So great, just be unselfish, Beth. You know, it's like, I mean, that's like saying, oh, you're homeless? Just buy a house, you know. If I knew how to do that. So what I had to look at is, okay, here's my defects. And we get our defects, that, you know, at the end of step 5, we're in the, when we write step 4, you know, we've got our defects out here now. And we know what they are. But now I'm going to take them and maybe just draw a line down the middle of a paper. But on one side, I'm not just going to write the defect. I'm going to write what it looks like when I'm doing it. Okay? How does this manifest in my behavior? And which defect is it? Which defect was that with my mom all those times? Arrogance, you know? I probably still had a scorekeeper in my head because, you know, I never wanted her to win. I mean, I could have an argument with her on the way to her house, lose, get to her house, and she'd come out. I mean, she wasn't even in the car, and I would lose, you know? And so I never wanted her to get one over on me. And we tend to do that in relationships, you know? It's a little score. And by the way, relationships are not 50-50. They're 100-100. Just saying. Because if it's 50-50 and you're doing, you know, if I'm doing 51, then I just can't help but notice that you're only doing 49. And so, honey, if you both put everything you got in, you know, it's got a good chance. And some days everything I have might only be 20% of what's needed, but Chuck and God can make up the other 80%. And other days it's the other way around. But I look at the defect and what does it look like when I'm doing it, you know, and I am super impatient, used to be. If they're driving too slow in front of me, if there's, you know, the worry. I'm an accountant, okay? So I still don't know how that happened. They're not my people. I'm with Sharon. I you know, I work in a CPA firm in Raleigh, and every now and then I say what I really think, and it just gets super quiet. I told this not too long ago, but back when the tax law was changing big, coming up, there's going to be big changes in 2010, and it involved no estate tax that year. It was like, it used to be this much, and then there was an exemption this much. And then in 2010, you could die, and it did not matter if you were a bazillionaire, there was zero estate tax in 2010, right? So it's 2009, and I'm at some big, you know, continuing education thing, and of course, they're accountants, so they're all talking about it at lunch, too. And so they said something about next year no estate tax, and I said, yeah, that's the year I'm going to throw my mom down the stairs, and I went back to my sandwich. And I looked up, and they're all just kind of, they got their sandwich in midair. And they're all just looking, not quite sure what to think, and it's just like, oh, did I say that out loud? Oh. I mean, wouldn't you? You know, may as well get the whole pie. So I count stuff is the bottom line. And people count or they don't. If you're a counter, you know who you are. You know, I'll be driving down the road and all of a sudden I realize somebody's going 22, 23, 24 because we're counting the, like, phone poles, you know. And so I know if you're ahead of me and you have 15 items in the 12-item line. Okay. I don't even have to really count them all. I can just tell. And so stuff like that. And what I realized was I am just saying that my time is more important than anybody else's. You know, that I am so important that you must serve me now. And so what's the opposite of that? You know, I'm going to take my time. I might let somebody in line in front of me. You know, I'm going to smile at the cashier when I get there, even if it's taken 22 minutes. You know, I'm going to hand her the money. I'm going to small talk with her. You know, because I have worked on the service side of things, and it's incredible how many people make no eye contact. They throw the money on the counter. You know, and if they have had a bad day, you know, they get the brunt of it. And so I started, you know, again, what would a kind person do? What would a kind person look like? And it's, you know, because a lot of times we get all caught up in being good and bad. This is bad. This is good. I was bad. This is good. I want to be good. And it's like, you know, I think God wants us to be kind, you know. I mean, we are all God's kids, all of us. And sometimes, you know, it's like we should just play nice with the other kids. It's just not that hard, you know. What does this look like when it manifests in my behavior, okay? And so I go down, and there's a lot of defects. You know, the 12 and 12 kind of has the seven deadly sins, but after my sponsee's experience with Unapproachable, I thought, well, I'll just look up some of these other ones too. And again, because I, you know, greed, gluttony, pride, anger, envy, lust, sloth, you know. But, you know, greed, selfishness, stinginess. You know, I never thought of greed as being stingy. Like, you can't have it, it's mine, you know. Gluttony, never enough, you know, grasping for other people's stuff. Pride, here's my big one, arrogance, you know, vanity, self-importance. That one, that's the one that I went, ugh, you know, because, I mean, I'm important, just ask me. And, you know, anger, indignation, bitterness, resentment, discontent, annoyance, you know, envy, jealousy, longing, discontent, rivalry, lust, desire, greed, status-seeking, power-hungry. You know, I always just think of lust as like lust, you know, like him, Mr. Right Now. And, well, I dated at last call. I don't know where you dated. But I never thought of lust as status seeking or that quest for power, you know. And sloth, I sadly can relate to, you know, lazy, idle, procrastinate, passive, inactive. My husband's got a master's degree in social work. A lot of you guys know Chuck. And he told me one day that I had a type AL personality. And I was like, what is that? And he goes, well, I'm certain you're type A, but you're lazy enough that you're not annoying. And there's some truth to that. But if these are all the different, you know, all the different meanings for the same word, then, you know, I've got all these. What do they look like when I do them? So now what I'm going to put on the other side is, if I was doing the opposite, what would that look like? And now I'm back to the same thing that we did in step one, right? I have a new set of behaviors to substitute for the old behavior. And one of the women I sponsor had a relationship with her mom a lot like I did. And so we did this exercise, and she had the eye rolling, the body language, interrupting on the phone, you know, huffy, sighing, the whole thing. And so we looked at what would the opposite of that look like. You know, don't slouch in your chair. Sit up. Look attentive. Make eye contact. Don't interrupt on the phone. You know, and so she went out to practice this. And within three weeks, that her relationship with her mom completely turned around. I mean, it did a 180. I mean, sometimes it works fast, but that was fast. But it just, you know, it just does, because we can go out. And I really think when I got sober, I thought the wind had stopped blowing. And you know, by 3 years when I'm still sober, now I'm seeing that, oh, I'm still doing that stuff sober. Because I used to read How It Works, and I think, yeah, I did that when I drank. And then I kind of could see you guys doing a little bit now, but not me. And then, you know, around 3 years, I read again in that, you know, trying to arrange the lights and the scenery. And I, you know, if only people would do as I wish, can they all see how good it would be? And I just went, oh, crap, I did that last week, you know. So I set about on, you know, trying to do the opposite of what, and Joe and Charlie break it down super simple. They just say, don't do what you want to do and do what you don't want to do. You know, but if I, you know, if I'm greedy, what's the opposite behavior from that? Generosity, charitable, unselfish, honorable, bountiful, giving. You know, how much do I give? How much do I, you know, I will start to think that, you know, money's getting a little tight, and then I see somebody who money's really tight for, and I realize that I could just cut two lattes a week out and probably change their entire financial situation You know, money is so relative. And I used to love when Pat and Vince Yeo would say, you know, no matter how much you make, you always think if you just had $10,000 more, you'd be okay. And So we are overpaid. We are overpaid. Chuck and I are overpaid. And, you know, we just look at our life and think, how did this even happen? This was not, you know, I walked in. I've got a beautiful room here. It's a corner room. It's huge. And I walked in. I just started laughing. I'm like, well, Toto, you are not in the Dewdrop Inn anymore, you know. But you can't get here from the Dewdrop Inn without the power of God. You know, and I know you're hearing a lot about God this weekend, and that's, you know, I tell people there's good news and bad news. The bad news is this is all about God, and you may not be happy about that, but the good news is this is all about God, and you'll become happy about that. I was not praying when I got here because I didn't want them to know where I was, and I was under the radar with Angie. And so I had grown up, you know, believing in them, but what I found when I got here is I didn't have a clue how to trust them. I didn't have a clue how to rely on him, how to handle my things better than I did. And, you know, when I got out of his way, somebody said once in the Big Book meeting where I got sober, he said, I really think God gave us AA to just keep us busy and out of his way, you know, and then he can fix our lives. And anybody who's ever had a toddler knows what that means. You know, you give him a toy to go play with so you can cook dinner and run the house. And it's like AA has just been my shiny thing. You know, I'll be thinking on trying to fix something and my phone will ring and what, you know, you can, and I'm just like, oh, now, you know, but what am I going to say? Sorry, I'm thinking. I'll have to call you back. So then I get distracted and then I forget what I'm trying to fix and then God's like, yes. The opposite of gluttony is moderation. Who does that? Moderation, you know. Level-headed, rational, satisfied, reasonable. Those were not in my vocabulary when I got here. You know, the opposite of pride is humility, which includes tolerance, gentleness, and godliness. I didn't see that coming. Peacefulness, you know, to be peaceful of heart, to be alone at perfect peace and ease. Joy is the opposite of anger. You know, and under joy is gratitude, contentment, and peace, and delight. You know, I don't know about you guys, but my vocabulary started to change when I got here. Some of it really needed to change. But I mean, I heard myself saying things like fabulous, and wonderful, and amazing. And, you know, those are not words that we were using much in the Dewdrop Inn in Norwood, Ohio. And I realized I meant it, too, you know. Every year for probably the first 5 years I was sober, I drove the same way to work. And I was in Ohio. That was my first resentment, Ohio. And but I drove to work the same way every day. So it snows, of course, which was most of my resentment about Ohio. I just was born for the South, apparently. Anyway, so every year I would notice a different color flower. You know, I didn't realize how much I just never saw. Like the leaves were gone, and then they're green, and then they're red. But I never noticed, I couldn't have told you until I was probably 6 or 7 years sober, that the trees flower before the leaves come out. I just never noticed, you know. I just drove around with blinders on. And I started seeing all this and seeing new life every spring and seeing the different, you know, the first year I noticed the tiger lilies, because how can you not? You know, but the next year it was the little flowers next, the little purple ones. And then, you know, the bushes, the forsythias. And I'll tell you, in North Carolina, the azaleas don't bloom. They explode. You know, you just walk out and it's like fireworks on the ground. It's amazing. But all of that, taking delight in that, taking pleasure in that, being happy for somebody else when something good happens for them instead of thinking, where is mine? You know, I got my first home group was a 200-person speaker meeting in Cincinnati, the giant East 4th Street group. And we kind of moved. About 100 of us would go, like your Louisville crew back there. Cincinnati was the same way. We would go, you know, down to the Kentucky State Convention, and there'd be 100 of us, you know, in the first three rows. And so kind of the patriarch of our group and another woman in our group were getting married. And I was so happy for them, I cried. You know, I thought, wow, where did that come from? Because I was about 6 months sober. And then A little while down the road, another couple, you know, got engaged and got married, and I was happy for them. And then Angela got engaged, and I just thought, I've been sober longer than her. You know, new costume, same defect. The opposite of envy is gratitude. And I heard early, you cannot be pissed off and grateful at the same time. And it's really hard to be depressed and grateful at the same time. You know, because for me, depression is focusing on what I don't have and what you didn't do for me and what I can't ever get. And gratitude is what I do have, you know, and what I can give to others. And the fact that we actually receive from giving, not from taking. So gratitude is so important in my life. Thankfulness, appreciation, and here's one that hadn't occurred to me, you know, pleasantness. So I try to be pleasant wherever I go. You know, I guess the accountant side of me, really small talk and stuff, I just was horrible at it. I mean, even my husband would come to my company Christmas party and he'd talk to everybody. I'd just follow him around because he's a social worker and they all talk to everybody. But, you know, and I probably was 20, 25 years sober and I just went, this is ridiculous, you know. So I started practicing on people on airplanes because I knew I'd never see them again, you know. You know, and now I'll talk to anybody. We'll get, and it's just, you know, it's crazy little stuff like, you know, I travel a lot of weekends, and when I get home on Sunday, I'm tired, and I get my luggage, and I go wait for the guys that drive the green van that takes us to our cars. But every single Sunday when I climb up in there, I always say to them, I am always so glad to see you because I know I'm home. And isn't that nicer than just, you know, throwing your suitcase at them and stomping onto the truck? You know, it's like, it is just as easy to be kind as it is to not be kind. But my reflex for a long time was not kindness. But just like getting sober and practicing, you know, we got sober and it was hard and we had to really think about what we're doing. And then, you know, then it got a little more automatic and then it was easy. And then one day we discovered we loved it, right? But what changed? The actions are the same. The actions are the same now to stay sober as they were when I was new. But while I was taking the action, God changed my heart. And that's because God changes hearts here. You know, hearts are healed here. Broken hearts are healed. Hearts that, you know, are closed, we get to open them up a little. And in my prayer when I come into these things is, God, if there's a heart that's been closed and there's just a little crack in the door, just please blow through it before they change their mind, you know. So we can heal broken hearts here through God. We can, and the people who come in joyous, we can just add joy. And we all get to be here for each other like this family reunion of the children of God. And I never knew I wanted to be a child of God. You know, I just wanted the best or the worst, fine, but just don't call me average, you know. And I didn't know that my strength would come from being one of many. And so step 6 and 7, the same thing. I'm practicing this stuff. I have to really think about what I'm doing. It's hard, you know, and then it's less hard, and then it's habit, and then all of a sudden, you know, I like doing it. Same action as when it was hard, but God has changed my heart. And I think that's what the 12 and 12 is talking about when it says, you know, he can't do this without our cooperation. So I'm not just going to pray to be come on, God, give me the willingness. I think the other thing that happens once we've been here for a while is that we start to blur the line between willing and want to, you know. So if I wake up and I don't want to do it, I think God hasn't removed it yet. And if I wanted to do it, what would I need willingness for, you know? If we have to be willing, that means we need to do it when we don't want to. If I wanted to do it, why do I need any help with that? And it's the same with acceptance and approval. You know, acceptance is not approval. Acceptance is just, this is the way it is. And, you know, I don't have to like it, but liking it or not liking it is not going to change the outcome. So when I had to resign from playing God, I had to let go of the outcome. You know, and surrender, which most of us think of as losing. You know, we have a friend who was in special forces, and he's about 15 years sober now. But he said the first time we heard him speak, he said it took me 2 years before I could say I surrendered instead of my position had been overrun. But, you know, again, going into the dictionary, surrender is just placing our outcome in the hands of another. You know, that's all it is. We're not losing. You know, we are just placing, even, you know, the Civil War, when Lee surrendered, he put his troops in the hands of the Union Army, you know, and hoped that it would be okay, but he placed their outcome in someone else's hand. That's what surrender is. I heard Father Terry once say that surrender is going to God with unsolved problems. You know, I was always wanted to be like, here's my problem and here's how I fix it. So here I am now. I'm good. You know, and it's so much easier to fix it with God's help. Lust, the opposite of that is contentment. Ease of mind, relaxed, satisfied, peaceful. And the opposite of sloth is spirited. I was so relieved it didn't mean like run 5 miles a day or something. I am not a runner. But spirited includes lively, brisk, eager, dynamic, active. And, you know, I mean, we had all been seeking spirit always before we got here. It's like somebody else touched on, you know, that Teresa, I think, that, you know, alcohol was my higher power. Alcohol made all my decisions, where I worked, where I didn't, if I worked, who I worked with, you know, which Mr. Wright it was, all of that. It made all those decisions. And we get here and they want us to turn it over, you know, to this God. And you just think, what? You know, it sounds crazy, but we're all standing here going, no, it works. But the thing is, when I started realizing that I had already been turning to, no matter if I was happy, if I'm happy, what am I going to do? I'm going to have a drink and celebrate. If I'm depressed, I'm going to drink to feel better. If you got fired, we're going to drink because you got fired. If you got a new job, we're going to drink because you got a new job. I mean, you know, certified letter, 3 drinks, and I intuitively know how to handle this, you know. Quit the job and throw away the letter. And so I was always turning to that power. And when I would start to get sober up, when it would start to wear off, I would be restless, irritable, and discontent and afraid because the power was farther away. And sometimes even just knowing it was in the car was enough, just knowing it was there. And so when we come in and we tell you, turn it over to God, and we don't turn it over in step 3, because I don't know about you, but type AL here, I would only need 3 steps if I could turn it over at step 3, you know. And through step 4 and 5, I have looked at, you know, really gotten a good look at myself. But step 6 and 7 lead me into, what do I do about it? You know, how does it change with the help of God? And I take the action and God changes my heart. And I take the action and God changes my heart. And you take the action and God changes your heart. And it's just a ride that you don't want to miss, you know. I tried so hard to stay out of Alcoholics Anonymous. So hard. And, you know, here I am. God. And I just couldn't be happier to be here, you know. Carl Jung wrote a letter. Bill wrote a letter to Carl Jung in 1961 because he realized he had never really told Dr. Jung about what happened after Roland had been there, because Roland, you know, was there. And basically, in layman's terms, Dr. Jung told him, you're screwed if you don't find God. I mean, he couldn't just say that, because back then you couldn't say that in a therapeutic community. But Roland came back, found the Oxford group. He found Ebby. Ebby found Bill. You know, the rest is history. And so in 1961, Bill thought, well, I should really probably, you know, write to him and tell him what happened. And so Dr. Jung wrote him back, and he said that, you know, the alcoholic, more than most, that he said that spiritus not only means alcohol, but God. And that he goes, it's so interesting that we use the same word for the highest power and the most depraved poison. Same word. And that when we're seeking one, we are blocked from the other. And he went on to say that he really had found, and he talked about in his day, he couldn't really say this, but that he had found, you know, most men and women are unable to resist that evil and that, you know, that our brains. And unless we have either basically a vital kind of conversion or the protective wall of human community. And those words really struck me. I'd read this letter on and off for years, but I never really noticed this protective wall of human community. And that's what Alcoholics Anonymous gives us when we get here. That's the fellowship. You know, we have this protective wall around us until we can find a God of our understanding, which has been there the whole time. We just weren't looking in the right places, you know. And so we have both here. We have a protective wall of human community. But for me, on its own, that is not enough. You know, the fellowship's awesome, but the change comes in the steps. You know, I cannot recover if I don't do these actions to get myself out of the way and clean up some of the wreckage. Because there's no vacuums in God's world. And as I get some of these things out, other things come in. You know, if you dump a glass of water upside down, it's not just pouring out. There's air coming into the glass. And so it is with God. There are no vacuums here. You know, if we are getting some of the garbage out, we're getting some of the damage out, there is more room for God to come in and do His work with us. And, you know, I just never thought my highest honor would be child of God. You know, it wasn't even on my list. But that's what we do here. We lift each other up. I, for one, never thought I'd be excited about spending a weekend with a bunch of women on purpose. And I do it several times a year, and I love it, you know. And we have all different kinds. 3 or 4 weeks ago, I was in Michigan at a small retreat, 60-ish women, you know. And now we're here with 700. And two of the ones from Michigan came down here to see what the other end of it looked like, you know, because that's what we do. We just say, come on, come with us, you know, come with us, drop the rock, you know, drop those burdens you're carrying around and come with us and we will carry you until you can walk, you know. And the last thing that Dr. Young said, he said, there's a phrase we have called spiritus contra spiritum, and it means the spirit against the spirit, that while we were in the grips of alcohol, God could not come in. The alcohol held it off. But on the other end of that, while we are in the arms of God, the alcohol doesn't have a chance. Spirit against spirit. And even this weekend, I've heard some people say, good, bad, good, I was good, I wanted, you know, I need to be good, I need to do this. And it's like, and they said something about being perfect. And I don't know if any of you noticed, because we tend to quote a lot like progress, not perfection. But they sneak a new one into the 12 and 12, and it says progress toward perfection. Toward perfection, that we are to aim that high. And I think what we forget sometimes is that when we are one with God, we are perfect in His eyes. We are perfect in His eyes. And we need to play nice with the other kids who don't know that yet. You know, not so that they can think we're awesome, but so that we can lead them to the one who has all power. Thank you. Thank you.